Let's go now to our regular Wednesday afternoon feature, Consumer Talk, with our consumer genius, Wendy Nola. Wendy, good afternoon.
Hello, Amy. Good to be with you. And I hope that I am with you for the full hour, because I am working out of Plet this week, and it had full stage 6 yesterday. So after 2.5 hours in the morning, we had 4 and a bit hours last night, and that's when cell phone tower batteries get hammered and tend to wobble and play havoc with signal. So far so good, but if something goes amiss, that's unfortunately what the reality that I found myself in this afternoon for this week's show.
Well, unfortunately,
and load shedding just started at 2.
Oh, yes, here too. And unfortunately, this seems to be a running thread throughout today's show, as we started the show with our very first interview just absolutely impossible due to also load shedding and difficulty to hear the guest.
I heard.
Anyway, let's
hold thumbs.
Let's plow on and see how we do. And the app that you've chosen now to talk about protecting food in your fridge and freezer in the time of load shedding.
Yeah, I thought I'd better do so, given the move to stage 6. Of course, those living within the Cape Town municipality borders were spared stage 6 last night, but for many others in the province, not so lucky. So we do need to up our game in terms of protecting our appliances, protecting the food in our fridges and our freezers, and getting the right insurance cover in place if we can afford it. So it's a massive topic, and it's, you know, we could definitely cover the whole hour, but I just had other material and I just wanted to cover a few of the basics quickly, given that it's just now such a sadly such a hot topic.
Yeah.
So consider having an electrician install a surge protector on your electric mains board. It's not something you can do yourself, but what you can do yourself is get plug adapters on your individual appliances. And these typically divert excess energy into the grounding wire built into the protector unit when a surge occurs, which often happens when the power comes back on, instead of allowing it to flow into the circuit that your valuables may be plugged into, and some are particularly vulnerable to surges. And then check whether your insurance policy does include surge damage, and if so, and this is very important, what they expect you to do in order for a claim to succeed. So the exclusion, so they may well require you to have surge protectors and that sort of thing, just as, you know, they will insure your car, but they want you to have a tracking device. Mm. They will insure your household contents, but you must have some kind of security. It's the same thing that applies. And now is really, if you haven't done it already, now is the time to get on top of that. And then Dr. Lucia Annelich, who is a food safety expert and owner of Annelich Consulting. She is a renowned food safety training expert. And she has a lot of very valuable advice and tips about keeping our refrigerated food safe. So she says, as long as the power is not out for more than 4 hours and the fridge door is kept closed and your fridge is running at no more than 4 degrees Celsius at the time of load shedding, you should be okay. Well, now we know, case in point here in Plet last night, we were out for more than 4 hours. And how do you know if your fridge is running at 4 degrees? You don't. You need to invest in a thermometer. This is critical now. Keep it in the fridge. Lucia says that most South African fridges are running at more than 4 degrees Celsius. So that is going to obviously reduce the amount of time that your food is going to stay safe during load shedding. So there's a very key pieces of advice. The food that is most susceptible to spoilage are, I suppose, the obvious ones, or, you know, food safety concerns, fresh meat, fresh poultry, fresh fish, milk, soft cheeses, and big one, this, because we all do it, leftovers in the Tupperware, in the old ice cream tub,
ice cream,
depending
container.
On how long they were in.
Yeah, a regular feature
depending
in
on
our
how
fridge.
Long they were in the fridge. Yeah, all of us, I think, to some extent. So Lucia says it's best to discard those foods if the outage was longer than 2 hours and where fridge temperature was higher than 4 degrees. So obviously stage 6, which can technically involve outages of 4.5 hours, it makes a lot of the food in our fridge potentially risky. She says different bacteria start growing at different minimum temperatures, but for every 1 degree Celsius increase above the minimum growth temperature, bacteria in food double they will grow faster, sure. double. So it's essential to keep the door closed and ensure that the temperature stays as low as possible during the outage. Frozen foods remain frozen for 48 hours. Again, if the freezer door is kept closed. Of course, those lovely deep chest freezers, I'm so glad I invested in one. They're, you know, there's a lot of volume there, so the food in there is safest. It can keep the temperature for the longest, and obviously the fuller it is, the more that applies. And if perishable food does start to thaw, you must then use it immediately. You cannot refreeze it because that creates all sorts of food safety issues. And she does realize, you know, as do we all, given the cost of food, many of us are very loath to throw something away, but you must bear in mind that just because it tastes and smells fine doesn't mean it is fine. Food can be unsafe, ridden with potentially harmful bacteria without us being able to discern that through taste, touch, smell, and the rest. So, and here, just quickly before we end this topic, is some really great advice. So, as you go into load shedding, and it's particularly helpful if you have a chest freezer, but any freezer will do, take your leftovers, your milk, your chicken, fish, put it into the freezer for that time and take it out afterwards. Obviously, if you don't have that available, buy smaller quantities of food now and cook and consume quickly rather than buying in bulk and having them sitting in the fridge for a long period of time. Buy long life products such as milk, canned goods, which things that have a long shelf life outside of the fridge while unopened. You can obviously, this is a good one and I'm definitely going to start doing it. Frozen ice packs can be packed around perishable foods in the fridge to keep them cold as long as possible. You don't have to buy ice packs. You can fill empty milk or cool drink bottles, 2-liter bottles, and use them to put in the fridge, frozen obviously during load shedding. And this is a new one on me, Amy, to test if your freezer contents are still okay. Yeah. You fill a glass with water, you freeze it, more likely a plastic glass, not a glass glass, which will crack. Place a coin on top of the frozen water in that cup. Leave it in the freezer. If you open the freezer at any time and the coin is where you left it, everything's good to go, good to eat. If you find the coin at the bottom of the glass, it's a good indication that your food has defrosted. Not so great. If you find it somewhere in the middle, it's a bit iffy. You need to make a judgment call that works for you and your family. I thought that it was definitely worth sharing. So, you know, as I say, I haven't scratched the surface of, you know, load shedding survival tips, but I think those were some of the more important ones.
Definitely. I like the ice pack idea, and I'm sure, you know, at least a way to pass the time is to fill the glass of water and put it in the freezer and check on that. That's
exactly
a great idea. Wendy, just before we move on to the next topic, I mean, my brother and sister-in-law recently experienced 4 days of power outages. That was in Johannesburg, 4 consecutive days, and had to throw away all the food in their fridge and freezer and defrost the freezer. Is there anything that can be done to not waste the food?
Well, very difficult over that amount of time. You would find stuff in your chest freezer. If it passed the coin test, might be okay. I really don't know. Over 4 days, I was concentrating on sort of your 4-hour scenario. But yes, parts of Job, Gauteng, and certainly KZN as well have had much longer outages. So that's where your thermometer comes in. Okay. And I would think over 4 days. I mean, it says don't open the door. That's difficult. One of the things I did read was to isolate your most perishable things into a big cooler box and replenish with ice. You can get it. I mean, you can pop off to your garage shop and get it and that kind of thing. And just keep testing the temperature. Luckily, it's winter, so these things are a little easier, especially here in the Cape and Gauteng. And the other thing I would suggest, and thank you for the question, is to check your insurance policy. So many of them will cover the spoilage from power outage. I think it's a very good idea because insurance companies always want proof of everything, is to just get into the habit, and it sounds painful, but we have cameras on our smartphones. So take photographs, keep receipts. If you're buying in bulk, you know, you're buying packs of meat, they're very used to people saying, well, you know, I had 24 packs of smoked trout in my freezer and they cost this. No, 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 they're not going to go for that. So get into the habit of keeping your receipts if you are buying in bulk and taking it. So you need to be able to prove it, yeah, ideally. Otherwise, they'll give you the minimum payout. So I think that's something we should all consider, because, you know, stage six and then what, stage eight? We don't know. Just prepare for the worst, I think.
But definitely the
you spoke about resilience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on that note, there's a big red banner on my screen right now saying power alert, Eskom update. As previously communicated, stage six load shedding will regretfully be implemented at 4 o'clock until 10 o'clock tonight. Stage four will then continue until midnight and tomorrow. So there we go. That's confirmed. Stage six again this afternoon.
Sounds like we're trapped in a really awful reality show.
Absolutely. And sounds like we all need to go and start sorting out our fridges with ice packs and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think a lot of us have got sick from food we've eaten and not realized what happened, or just felt a bit off, or, you know, spiked a temp or something like that, without realizing what had happened. And I think, gosh, I don't want to even imagine if this is still our reality in summer. The food spoilage issue is going to be intensified, obviously.
And it's just tragic, because it's something that we can so little afford. I mean, as I mentioned at the start of the show, when we were talking about resilience, petrol, groceries, everything has skyrocketed. That to take a fridge full of food
side
that we have to now throw away is absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, what do you say? And everything's going up, and the petrol price is causing the food to go up, and going to get the food and replace the stuff in the freezer is then. It's just a never-ending bombardment of horrible, expensive things. We're all in it together, and all we can do is try and work with it and accommodate it, because all the swearing and wishing is not going to help. We have to just up our game and deal with it, unfortunately.
Well, thanks for addressing that, Wendy, and thanks for those very good tips in terms of what we can do when it comes to keeping our food a bit fresher. Let's move on now, and we're addressing a medical scheme concern that came in last week, I believe.
Yeah, so very towards the end of the show, I think the dying minutes, we had a call from listener Charlene, who shared with us her experience of a medical scheme claim around pathology tests, which went horribly wrong. I'm hoping we have the clip to play.
It's been rather frustrating. In December, my daughter was taken up in a well-known hospital group with a terrible flu. They ran some tests, and the two tests that they ran, one was a bacterial blood test, and the other one was viral, because obviously doctor wanted to see, you know, she's got, she didn't have COVID. She ended up having influenza A. Going forward, I got the bills. The medical aid paid out for the one blood test, and then I got a bill from the pathologist to say that the other one is not paid for. So I communicated with my medical aid, asking them, do they not cover for one or the other? They said they cover for both, for bacterial and viral blood tests. So I conveyed this back over to the pathologist and said that the medical aid does not recognize the code that they give for the viral blood test, or the bacterial, one of the two. So it was this way, that way, emails being sent. Eventually, the outcome is that the pathologist saying, well, sorry, we're not going to change the code to suit your medical aid. And the medical aid says, well, we don't recognize the code, and you are covered for both. We will pay it, but we can't enter the number, that the code that they're giving us. And now, next thing is they want to hand me over, and it's quite a big, fat bill. So William, what do I do?
Have you tried sort of asking the pathology to explain how their codes don't match up with the medical aid one?
I have a virtual paper trail on emails asking that, and they've just come completely back. The pathology saying they are not prepared to change the code. Even my medical aid, which is really excellent, great service to them, they've contacted them directly and said to them, we do cover for bacterial and viral. Please give us a new code so we can pay you. The pathologist lab says completely, no, we are not changing it. I must settle the bill. And my medical aid says they don't know what to do more about it.
Sure. So poor Charlene finds herself in a predicament there. And fortunately, as is often the case here at Cape Talk, we had a listener who came to the rescue. Correct, Wendy?
Well, not quite.
Came to the rescue, but stepped up, let's say. Stepped up to help provide some answers.
So what we did was, we, as always with such interesting cases, we asked Charlie to email us with the details that we could take up the case. But sadly, we haven't received that email yet. I'm hoping she's listening and she's going to remedy that, because we really are committed to getting to the bottom of that one. It sounds fairly straightforward. But listening to that was Dr. David Green, who's MD of Med Claim Assist, which is a Cape Town-based company helping people to get their claims paid. There are several companies that provide that service. And the fact that there are several companies will tell you that this is an issue. Sometimes we consumers just aren't up to the task of, you know,
having
the codes,
the
PMBs and everything else. It's very, very complicated. So David emailed us shortly after the show to say, when there is an issue with the medical scheme payment, there are four possible things that need to be looked at. The scheme may have made an error in the processing of the claim. The doctor may have made an error in the coding of the claim, or in this case, the pathologist. The patient may have made an error in accessing the services to ensure full payment. Or number four, there is no error and the payment is correct and what should have happened. I'm not quite sure what he means by that. But he says, I was concerned with what I heard, and admittedly, I did just catch the tail end. The woman said she'd asked the provider to change the diagnosis coding to ensure full payment by the scheme. The complaint was that the provider refused to change the coding. My first question would have been, was there in fact an error on the coding of the in the coding of the provider's claim? If not, then asking them to change it is in fact attempting to commit fraud against the scheme. In many instances, it requires clinical insights and detailed knowledge of the medical schemes to determine if there's a problem, where the problem might be. And it's, you know, it's very complicated. Mm. He said, in this case, of course, though, we know that the medical scheme did say that it does pay for both types of blood tests. It was just a curious case of coding, with the pathologist saying, well, we're not changing our codes to help your medical scheme. And obviously, something needs to be broken there, but it wasn't certainly a case of fraud. The medical scheme, in fact, if you listen to Charlene, often did directly engage with the path lab on this, and still the standoff continued. But I thought it was a good reason. It's kind of piqued our interest in what can go wrong with medical claims. And so after the break, we will have David with us to talk about and share some case studies around this very prickly issue.
I'm so glad because you say what can go wrong. I hate to be cynical, but what can go right with medical claims? I've just been through this complete rigmarole myself, and I tell you what, like you say, many of us just aren't equipped for the fight and for the challenge that faces us. So let's unpack that after the eyewitness news.
Cape Talk.
Consumer Talk.
WhatsApp on 072-567-1567.
It is 22 minutes to 3 o'clock. It is Wednesday afternoon, which means we're in conversation with our consumer guru, Wendy Nola. And just a reminder to you, if you've got a consumer issue or something that you'd like Wendy to explore or unpack for you, you can email her at consumer@nola.co.za. Again, that's consumer@nola.co.za. And this afternoon, we're talking about medical aid schemes and claims that can go wrong and how they can go wrong, as well as the codes that are associated with them. And Wendy's very kindly brought in the Managing Director of MedClaim Assist, Dr. David Green, to answer some of our questions this afternoon. So thanks for joining us on the line now, David. I imagine that there are many, many, many people that receive a bill for some kind of medical service or procedure and do not have, you know, all the information at hand, so often just pay the bill without questioning whether the codes are correct or whether that is in fact something that they should be paying.
Hi, Amy. Yes, and thank you for having me. That is indeed so. And even if there is a feeling that something is not quite right with this bill and the medical aid should pay more or something else should be fixed on it, people often give up just in frustration at the jargon and the level of difficulty in dealing with these issues between providers, being doctors and medical schemes.
And that, I think, is exactly why you made contact with us and with Wendy after hearing Charlene on the radio, correct?
Yes, that's right. So I didn't hear the Charlene's full call, but I picked up the end of it, and I thought that that, yeah, that often there needs to be a medical professional to medical professional conversation about the coding, and particularly pathologists who say they are not consulting clinicians and they never make the diagnosis. So they would provide a set of information off a set of tests to the diagnosing provider who then makes the diagnosis. So they often use nondescript codes in the Z category, to get a bit technical around the coding of encounters with the medical service, and then often that's not enough for the scheme, and there might need to be a discussion at a kind of clinical level with the pathologists to convince them that it's appropriate and correct to change their code in order to get it paid.
Thanks for explaining that, David. That brings me to one of my questions, because you shared with me off air that you've had a few cases involving pathologists and COVID-19 tests where the Z code has been problematic. If you could just explain for our listeners what happened there.
Yes. So COVID-19, unsurprisingly, has had the claims have been very well paid by medical aides, and barring one or two problems here or there, they've generally either paid them correctly or, when we've contacted them, fixed it very quickly. But we have run into a number of pathology claims where the patient has been positively diagnosed on the PCR test, and the Z code is used in the claim to the medical aid. And I think there's wrong on both sides, or errors on both sides here. In an episode of care, someone goes to hospital, they have a PCR test, they might spend some time in ICU or whatever. It's possible, in reviewing the full context of the claim, to understand that the Z-coded pathology claim is in fact for the PCR test and that the patient was positive. And similarly with the labs, I think it is not difficult for them to see a positive result and code appropriately. So we've been attacking that on both fronts, getting hold of the medical aid and saying, surely you can see the whole picture here and pay the claim appropriately, and getting hold of the pathologists and saying, you can see this as a positive diagnosis. You don't need to Z-code it. You can code it correctly.
Oh, gosh, complicated. And on the other thing that comes up a lot, particularly in my work, and must come to you a lot, is the issue of when something's an emergency and when it's not. So I have a case with someone, Medicheck in Joburg, which operates pretty much the same way as you do, David, where a woman, a Joburg pensioner, fell and broke her wrist. But because she didn't go straight to the hospital's emergency room, because she wanted her trusted orthopedic surgeon to do the op, and it was a Jewish holiday that he was observing at the time, she went in a couple of days later, and then on that basis of that, they refused to pay the 30,000 rand hospital bill, saying it wasn't an emergency procedure, it was elective and therefore not a prescribed minimum benefit. And so I've asked Mark to fight that one on my behalf, because, like you, David, he, you know, understands and deals with the medical schemes, knows how everything works intimately. But you also had a case that was sort of the same thing, whether it was an emergency or not, somebody who collapsed at home. Would you mind telling us about that one?
Sure. So a man collapsed at his home and was barely conscious. His wife took a decision to put him in the car and take him directly to the nearest hospital. and when she got there, he was having a heart attack and he needed stents put in. But the treating physicians decided that he needed to be stabilized for a period before they could do the procedures that they wanted to do on him. And so he ended up having the procedure a day after being admitted, and the medical aid, the medical scheme said this is not an emergency, because for two reasons: one, an ambulance didn't take the person to hospital, and secondly, the treatment was applied more than 24 hours after admission. Now, they're
so very similar to my case.
Yeah. So their rationale is that they only have to pay as an emergency if there is a threat to life and limb. That's the phraseology in the regulations. If the person is hospitalized for 24 hours or longer, then they could have been transferred to a doctor that has a contract with them, which they would have gladly paid in full because they bill at a lower rate in order to secure those contracts. But if they've been in hospital that long, there's often a discussion around this. Sometimes the different date of treatment is just because the admission was at 10 o'clock at night and the procedure was 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's a different date, but it's very clearly an emergency, and the scheme systems look at the date, but if you call in and ask them to correct that, they will. But sometimes the debate is around, is it appropriate to take someone who the physicians feel need additional stabilization before a procedure can be done and put them in a life support ambulance and move them to another facility with which the scheme has a contract. And that clearly is not clinically acceptable, and I don't think there's any doctor who would accept that.
And I wonder how many people would willingly sign up for a medical aid if they understood that those were the conditions.
Yeah. So it's this whole notion of a DSP or a designated service provider. The schemes can do that that they will only pay in full those providers, designated service providers, with whom they have a contract. And if there is an argument that can be made that there wasn't a threat to life or limb, then they will pay at the scheme rate and you would be liable for the balance. But as I say, there's always a debate around those, and is it appropriate to require a person to change their provider?
It's so interesting. I get a lot of medical scheme complaints that involve these emergency situations and the DSPs. So what would your general advice be in an emergency situation? This pensioner that I spoke about who fell and broke her wrist, she said her learning out of this whole process, because she's now left to pay 30,000 Rand for the hospitalization, was just go straight to the, preferably in an ambulance, but go straight to a hospital's emergency unit, casualty. Don't wait, don't go in your own car, unless, you know, that it's far quicker. But she said her learning was go straight to casualty. Is that something that you would support, given the cases that you handle?
So without a doubt, for any emergency, it is a risk to you clinically if you break a bone and then wait for a few days. There's a risk of deep vein thrombosis and various other issues. So in any emergency clinically, it's a good idea to get to the casualty as quickly as possible. And then in terms of getting your scheme to pay in full, treat it as an emergency and they will pay it as an emergency.
Okay. Very good advice. So what is the most common type of issue, complaint, dispute that comes to your company where the consumer is just unable to navigate it on their own and they feel that the claim's unfairly rejected?
So without a doubt, it's the payment for prescribed minimum benefits. There's a whole minefield of regulations around when and how a scheme can wiggle out of paying for prescribed minimum benefits in full. Those are difficult to navigate for most members of medical schemes. And yeah, it's well over two-thirds of the requests for assistance that we get.
And David, I've got a question, sorry to ask, but how does a consumer pay for your services? Would we hire you as a lawyer or a representative, or would you take a portion of whatever refund the consumer gets?
Yeah, so the way our system works is that if you have a query around a claim, we ask you to send us all the details and then we evaluate it. And if we believe we can help, then we would get back to you and say, we can help and this is the process from here on. And then there are really two options. The one is we charge a fixed fee, so we don't take a percentage at all. So we've costed out our services. We know what it costs to deliver the service, and we charge a fixed fee to cover those costs. Or we have a subscription model where you can pay an annual or a monthly fee, and then we would basically be there in support of you on an ongoing basis as the subscription is valid. So one of the things that we do is we monitor the data flow between medical providers and medical schemes on behalf of our clients, as long as obviously our clients have signed consent for us to access that information on their behalf. And then we're able to pick up really early in the process. So a doctor submits a claim, the scheme submits a real-time electronic remittance advice, and then we're at that stage already before there's a nasty letter from the practice or any unpleasantness or whatever, we know what's going on and can intervene to get it right. And so that obviously we can only do for our subscribers. For people who just approach us on a once-off basis, then we do the once-off thing.
Just to clarify,
the other side of that is if we feel we can't help, then and we, at the initial stage, if we can help, then we get back to you and explain how. If we can't help, then we don't charge at all. But what we do is give an explanation of why the claim has been correctly paid and how you might better access services in future to get a better result on the payment.
Excellent. That was the question I was about to ask you, the issue I was going to ask you to clarify. So thank you for that, David.
Okay.
Well, thanks.
Great. Thank you very much for sharing that.
Dr. David Green is the Managing Director of MedClaim Assist. I know after this conversation, I'm certainly going to view my medical bills a bit more circumspect. Wendy, or David, if you're still on the line, how can people reach out and find you if they need your services?
So the best is to get us through the web. It's medclaimassist.co.za.
Medclaimassist.co.za. There you go. Thank you so much, Dr. David Green. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Consumer Talk. Open line. Call 021-446-0567.
Well, we've got around 5 or 6 minutes left with Wendy Nola, our consumer genius. If you've got questions for her, now is the time to ask them. You can give us a quick call on 021-446-0567 or 072-567-1567. You don't need to stick to today's topics. We've been talking about how to preserve your food in your fridge or freezer during load shedding. And we've also been talking about medical aid schemes and the codes associated with them. But we are able to talk to you about anything that's on your mind or any questions that you have this afternoon. So get those in. You've got 5 minutes. Wendy, what are some of the things we're going to be taking a look at next week? Any idea yet?
Possibly the one that we're supposed to do this week, but I think that's more likely going to be in 2 weeks' time. There was a topic that we wanted to get to today, but we don't have enough time, and that is, are supermarkets doing enough to protect us from or to warn us against pickpockets in their stores? In the case in point, in my view and that of the victim of pickpocketing, it doesn't appear so. If you've had this happen to you in a supermarket or any retail store, we'd love to hear from you. I think, you know, it's a very interesting issue because, you know, crime is rife, and so we should expect this. You know, do we hold the stores responsible if it happens in you know, between their aisles, or is that not a fair expectation? What are we doing? Are we keeping our cell phones in our pockets, as my daughter does, drives me mad? Or are we, you know, it's a very interesting issue. So that's one of them that I can tell you for sure, and we'll see what the week ahead holds.
Great. Well, in the meantime, we've got a call from Amy in Greenpoint who wants to ask you about medical aid. Amy, good afternoon. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm interested to know what the part of a broker plays in terms of getting your medical aid, and is there any responsibility that falls onto them? The reason that I ask is because we changed our banks from Standard Bank to Investec, and on that month of changing, the debit order didn't go through. then subsequent debit orders went through, but it was returned unbeknownst to me. We didn't check. And then landed up in hospital with a heart attack to be told that your medical aid has now lapsed. And
wow,
I just want to know, like, is there some kind of recourse? Because after checking, you know, the correspondence, I think we found like one email from the medical aid saying, okay, your medical aid is going to lapse, in between like millions of sales calls and millions of other things. And we had a broker. And surely there has to be, like, when does the next of kin, or when does a broker, or how does it work? Because it just seems quite insane. And now to be dropped from medical aid, to start again with exclusions of all kinds, and to land in hospital with a heart attack to be told you have no cover.
Oh, that sounds to me like a very unfair situation, Wendy.
Amy, if you could just clarify, you said there was a switch from banks and then the debit order didn't go through. And what happened? So that was 1 month. What happened subsequent to that? How many months were missed before it lapsed?
So then I think it was 3 months.
Sorry, before I was.
Okay. Sorry, guys. 3 months. and each time the debit order was returned. So it went off, but then was returned back into the account.
Okay. I was going to say, if it was so just 1 month, then that would have been on very thin ice.
No, so they couldn't.
It depends on your agreement with the broker, and I'm not 100% sure, so I don't want to stick my neck out too far. But I mean, if you were getting all your correspondence from your medical scheme came via the broker, then I would say the broker bears some responsibility there for sure. But if you were getting, if you were being contacted directly by the scheme, and certainly with notification saying your cover will lapse, there should have been some warnings. If those had been ignored or not seen, then I think there would be little recourse because. Yeah, so that's if the broker had failed to inform you because he got the information, then that would have been on him or her. But so I think under the circumstances, just unfortunate series of events. And I think for any insurance we have, I cover a lot of cases of this, as you really have to be on top of your account and ensure they're quite large amounts, ensure that they have gone off and they haven't been reversed. Because, as I say, three strikes and you're out. It's very important. In fact, in the case of some insurers, it's 1 month or two months, 2 months, and then your cover lapses. And there's so much at stake. So, sorry, at your expense, but that's a very good warning to share with the listeners.
Sure.
Sorry, Amy.
Yeah, not a happy ending there, but thank you for sharing your story. It is very, good warning, as you say, Wendy, to the rest of us. Wendy, as always, thank you so much for all your hard work and your insight this week, and we look forward to being joined by you again next week, and all the best with that lengthy load shedding.
Thank you, and I'll be in studio next week, so all good, and I'm just happy that our connection held so well. Thanks, Amy.
Great. Thanks, Wendy. Well, I've actually got a question here I'll save from Mark for you for next week.